Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today, great writer, veteran NBA scribe, Sean Devaney. Sean, you may know his work from Heavy.com and, of course, longtime for the Sporting News. He's got a really great new book out. It's called The History of the NBA in 12 Games. It's 12 chapters, each focused on one game that made the NBA what it is today. It is not the usual approach. These are not the biggest highlights, the biggest scores, the biggest stats, or whatever. It is about moments that shaped the NBA. It's a totally unique approach, and Sean's a great writer. We will dive into some of those moments, including the game when the Jordan rules were essentially born and the Bad Boys were born, the game that signaled the end of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's run in Milwaukee, the first big superstar trade demand, essentially, the game that defined tanking in the 80s and led to the lottery. Moments like that, very cool. We will discuss all that and lots more. Before we get to that, two reminders. Please rate, review, subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Hit me with all your feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck. And don't forget, SI and Triumph Books have collaborated on a really cool new book about the history of the Lakers called The Greatest Show on Earth. I was honored to write the foreword for the book. It's available for pre-order with a 30% discount. Go to triumphbooks.com, search for Greatest Show on Earth. There's also a direct link in the summary of this podcast, or go to bit.ly/Lakers75 and then use the discount code Lakers30. That will get you the 30% discount. Again, triumphbooks.com, or use the bit.ly link, or find it in the summary of this podcast. Go check it out. Wonderful writing by some of the greatest writers in the history of Sports Illustrated about some of the greatest players in the history of the Lakers. Phenomenal book. Go check it out. Great for Lakers fans. Great for fans of just even great sports writing. Never too early to do your holiday shopping. Okay, plugs aside, my conversation with Sean Devaney is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by Sean Devaney. Sean, how are you, my friend?
Howard, good to see you.
Good to see you. We're toward the end here of the first week of NBA training camps. A lot going on. As we record this, I think the Warriors had a game that was at some point in the dark this morning, though not where they were, just just here on the East Coast of the U.S. I have no idea what happened in that game. I think James Wiseman went off. We'll catch up with that later. There's plenty going on around the league. Maybe we'll touch on that a little bit toward the end of the pod. But I wanted to have you on because I want to talk about your new book, The History of the NBA in 12 Games. It's a very cool approach, which I will let you explain in a second here. But so folks understand, it's the history of the NBA in 12 games. But this is not the obvious choices. This is not Wilt going for 100. This is not Michael's final shot against Utah. It's not Magic's baby hook. It's not Reggie 8 points, 9 seconds. It's not Bird versus Dominique in that wild playoff game. It's not Willis Reed coming out of the tunnel. It is not the things you expect. Also, by the way, trying to tell the history of the NBA in 12 games is quite a challenge in itself. So why 12, Sean? Why limit yourself to 12? And why this 12? And we will get to some of what did make the book.
Well, you know, a 12-man roster, I guess it kind of made some sense. Sure. And, you know, it's interesting because when you look back, you know, I think one thing about basketball and the NBA is that the history tends to get short shrift, you know, compared to certainly baseball history, football history. But I think that's changing somewhat, you know, going back to, I think, to Last Dance, I think had a big impact on that. And then maybe a little further back, Jackie McMullen's book about Bird and Magic. You know, I think there's been a little more interest in the history of the league. So that was something that I really wanted to try to dig into and find a way to do it that was accessible. You know, that is something that you can come in and read a chapter and get a sense of the history of the league in that era. So it starts with the 24-second clock in 1954. And you know, it's about that game, but then there's the whole chapter is about sort of where the league was at that time, why they needed a 24-second clock. Some of the characters, Danny Biasoni is a fascinating character, was the owner of the Syracuse Nationals. So it's a lot about him in there. He sort of is credited as the father of the 24-second clock. So, you know, I wanted to kind of, you know, have that approach where, you know, you've got a game and you can tell about the game, but you can also tell the context and why that game wound up being important going into the future. So, you know, that's how I approach it. That's how I kind of pick the games is not, like you say, not, you know, the ones that are the most memorable games, those games that people talk about and that you see on Hardwood Classics. I want the games that kind of influenced where the league went from there. That's what I try to do.
And that's what I love about this book. I should also note, by the way, Sean is coming to us live from Springfield, Massachusetts. So you are literally steeped in, surrounded by, soaking in the history of the game and the Hall of Fame in your backyard, along with, most importantly, the Dr. Seuss Park, which is,
yes,
my personal favorite part of Springfield. But this book, while not necessarily trying to focus on you know, the biggest statistical games, the biggest rivalry games, others that people would immediately call to mind when they think of like lists of the greatest games. This is not an attempt to be the greatest games. It's the most influential in some ways, but it still manages to pull in a major Bill Russell moment. Kareem, Magic, Bird, Jordan, Kobe, Shaq, Dirk, LeBron, and Steph Curry. And so as I read through those names and I realize that in some ways, okay, you just picked games that were influential in terms of the way the game developed, the way the league developed, more, you know, important inflection points, you still pull in a bunch of the all-time greats and a nice sample or cross-section of them across the decades. Did you have to kind of, I don't know, cross-reference to do that? Were you intentionally making sure that you got certain of these figures in there, or did it just kind of happen organically as you were looking for some of these important games?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I think in some way, you know, the games that do involve Michael Jordan are naturally going to be ones that have more importance. But, you know, I think if you take the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar game, for instance, the one that I picked was March 14th, 1975, when he's still playing in Milwaukee. And just a couple of days before that, Marv Albert broke the news that Kareem had requested a trade out of Milwaukee. Now, he had done it
a Marv bomb. We had a Marv bomb back in the 70s.
It was a Marv bomb. That's right. Yeah. And And it was funny to read the Milwaukee papers. Oh, this East Coast guy, he didn't know what he's talking about. but you know, of course, it was true. And I had talked to Kareem a lot about, you know, about how he handled his trade requests, and how he kind of kept it quiet, because he launched the request in October. It wasn't until March that it finally broke. It just so happened that they were playing the Lakers that night. And so it was sort of this whole confluence of things. And of course, we know what happened. You know, Kareem eventually gets traded to the Lakers. The Knicks absolutely blew it. That he really wanted to go to the Knicks. The Knicks blew it in terms of putting together a deal that could have gotten Kareem to New York. And so it's just that game, even though, you know, it's just a March game and neither of the teams were all that good. You know, that game sort of symbolized a lot of what was going on with Kareem in terms of getting him out of Milwaukee, what wound up happening with the Lakers. And, you know, the whole trade request thing, you know, I remember talking to Kareem a couple of years ago when Anthony Davis was going through his trade request stuff about, you know, why is this guy handling it this way? This is all wrong. And you know, certainly the Kevin Durant stuff, you know, it still echoes. So those are the kind of games that I was looking for. You know, maybe not the obvious ones, like you say, but the ones that, that did sort of symbolize where things were and the way things changed after that.
And something else that you've done along the way here, again, like there's one game from the 1950s. You alluded to it earlier, the first game with the 24-second clock, which obviously is a very important innovation for this game. Yeah. Who knows where basketball would be if not for that back then. So that's the one game from the 50s. You have one from the 60s, one from the 70s. That was the Kareem game you just mentioned. Three from the 80s, three from the 90s, one from the early aughts, and a couple from the 20-teens. And so, again, I think a nice spread of the eras. We'll get to a couple more of the ones that you did highlight. What were the toughest ones that you left out, or how many did you start with? Because even if you're not necessarily trying to focus on the most statistically, you know, gargantuan games or the biggest rivalry games or those kinds of, you're going for a different subset. I'm sure there were others that, you know, in one way or another were also influential. So what were, before we get to some of the things you did cover, what were some of the ones that you wanted to get in there, couldn't quite get?
Yeah, probably the big thing that the book doesn't have in it that I went back and forth on is Spencer Haywood and you know, everything that he kind of went through to get on the floor and the impact that had. The reason that I ultimately left that one on the cutting floor was that it was very much a court battle. You know, the legal system, not on the court, and because of that, it kind of didn't fit the spirit of the rest of it. Obviously, you know, he had such a huge impact on NBA history and what he did. So you know, that's probably the big one and anytime, you know, you get a chance to talk to Spencer Haywood, you have a reason to talk to him. It's always going to be fun. He's going to tell some stories. So I was kind of, you know, I really wanted to get that in because I do think it's something that's important and he's such a great storyteller. But I just felt in the end that it was more of a legal system thing rather than, you know, the game on the floor.
Yeah. Also, his story's, of course, been well told, including by our friends Gary Washburn and Mark Spears recently in their book, which was, I think, 2 years ago now. People should go. Mm-hmm. Check that out. I also realized that I wasn't sure how to take this other than I'm freaking old, but of the 12 games you highlighted in your book this is NBA history. So automatically this makes it feel like this is reaching back a ways. And I was present at and covered three of these 12.
Yeah.
It should have been four. It should have been four. The one that I did not. One of the ones you highlight was in the 1998 All-Star Game in New York at Madison Square Garden. That is Kobe versus MJ, a major moment as, you know, Kobe is trying to not just take the baton, but just like steal the baton and smack people around with it. I was not at that game because that was my first year covering the Lakers for the LA Daily News, a famously cheap operation that did not send me to the All-Star Game on my first season covering the Lakers, despite there being four Lakers in that game: Shaq, Kobe, Eddie Jones, and Nick Van Exel. Not that I'm still bitter about it or anything. So I did not cover that one. However, I was at the last three chapters of your book includes the infamous Western Conference Finals Game 6, Sacramento and the Lakers, the infamous referee, lots of fouls, people crying conspiracy still to this day game. I was there covering that. Mm-hmm. Chapter 11, you've got Eastern Conference Finals Game 6, June 2012. That was Heat over Celtics, LeBron going for 45 and 15. I covered that one for the New York Times. And then
not only that, Howard, but I believe I referenced your lead in that chapter because it was a really good lead.
Thank you.
And that was and I was at that game as well, and you just had a sense that you just watched something different, that you know, things were going to be different after that.
I get chills still thinking about that game. I remember that night. Like, I don't remember details of game. I don't know about you, but like a lot of the details fade. I can remember a feeling or I can remember a moment sometimes, but a lot of times it's just more of like, oh, I remember where I was sitting within the press section and, or maybe something that happened post game in the interviews or whatever. But it's that night. I just remember thinking like, holy shit. And we've all seen some stuff after you've covered the league for a while. That one was really memorable. And then it was really funny. So my last year covering the NBA and the Knicks for the New York Times, I had been off the Knicks the 12-13 season covering the Nets, but they pulled me back onto the Knicks midseason because they were having this kind of renaissance, the Knicks. My first game back on the beat is the last chapter of your book, which was Steph going for 54 and hitting 11 of 13 threes.
That was your first game back on the Knicks beat?
My first game back on the Knicks beat after a few months on the Nets, and then turned out to be my last season on the Knicks and for the New York Times at all because I left for Bleacher Report later that year. So there you go. The last three games of your book I did cover. This certifies me as old.
well, you know, the Steph game wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long. Yeah, but it's all right. But listen, you've covered the history of the NBA in 12 games, and I was at 3 of 12, which I believe works out to 25%. And it should have been, as I say, a fourth game, which would have worked out to a third of them. So that's something. All right. So let me hit some of these that are really, you alluded to the Kareem one. First major trade request by a superstar, this all the way back in the 70s. And of course, that is the reference point for everyone else now when we talk about, oh, you know, stars don't want to stay with their teams anymore. No, it's been going on for a very long time.
Yeah.
The chapter after that, April 14th, 1984, game between the Kansas City Kings and the Houston Rockets. The significance of that game, I think, also should resonate quite a bit in today's NBA. Why was that game chosen?
Yeah, you know, the Kings at the time, the Kansas City Kings, were fighting for the final playoff spot in the West. Houston really had nothing to lose. They were playing for something much different. They were playing for what they hoped would be the number one pick or was going to be one of the top two picks. The way that it worked at the time was, the worst team in each conference, they had a coin flip, and the winner of the coin flip got the first pick, and the loser got the second pick. So it was down to the Clippers and the Rockets, but the Clippers, their pick had belonged to Philadelphia. So, you know, on the final night of the season, you have this situation where Houston, which was 20-26 to start February, then went 9-27 to close out the year. The Rockets had been tanking. I mean, that it was just blatant. I talked to Pat Williams, who was the GM of the Sixers at the time. Again, they had the Clippers pick. So they thought, you know, Clippers were 15-30 at the start of February. You know, Pat Williams is thinking, I'm going to get, you know, either Olajuwon, or he told me that they were serious about taking Michael Jordan if they had wound up with the first pick or the second pick and he was still there. That was how this was supposed to play out. The Clippers were supposed to be the worst team in the league, and the Sixers would get their pick, and Michael Jordan would be a Philadelphia 76er, except that the Houston Rockets went 9-27. They lost 8 of their last 9 games. They were winning this final game on April 14th against Kansas City, and Bill Fitch, the coach, all of a sudden starts making some weird substitutions, and they have like a 12-point lead, and all of a sudden it's gone in the fourth quarter. They wind up losing the game. They get the number one pick. And of course, we know what happens. They take Olajuwon. You get Sam Bowie going to Portland, and Michael Jordan winds up in Chicago. Philadelphia as their consolation prize. They wind up fifth, and they take, of course, Charles Barkley. So, you know, that set up, you know, all these Hall of Fame players for where they would be just with that one game. You know, if Houston wins that game, everything's much different. And the other thing that comes out of that is what they call the Rocket Rule. It was clear that they had tanked. David Stern came up with and really jammed this through. A lot of the GMs did not like the way all this unfolded. David Stern came up with the lottery system right then and there. And in July, so after the season ends in July, they have a meeting in Salt Lake City, and he rams through the lottery system, and that becomes how we do the draft from there. So that game, you know, like I say, it's kind of a nothing game, but it winds up being pretty huge in terms of how everything plays out.
And that's what I love about the book, Sean, and much credit to you for basically deciding, like, I'm going to drill down. I'm going to find, in this case, this sliding door moment where it didn't just, you know, lead to indirectly the lottery, or somewhat directly the lottery, something that is now, of course, a staple of the league and of their system and of trying to create some sense of fairness and parity and equity. But, you know, the game itself has all these other sliding door moments within it in terms of where everybody might have been drafted that year in what was one of the all-time great drafts. So it's a lot of fun to kind of see it recontextualized that way, because I don't, most of us, even if we were alive for it, you just don't remember it that way. And it's only kind of through the prism of hindsight that you go, oh, wow, well, there were a lot of implications from this otherwise meaningless game.
Yeah. There's, you kind of look back on the way things played out as being inevitable. But when you go back and you surround yourself with the media at the time, and the magazines and the newspapers and what was being written and said at the time, and you talk to the people who were there, obviously, you get a real sense that, that what we now kind of look back on as inevitable certainly was not. I mean, this there was a lot of different ways. At one point, Philadelphia was pretty confident that they would get Michael Jordan, and they were shopping Dr. J. I mean, they had a trade lined up that would have sent Dr. J to the Clippers, and they wound up pulling off of it. Some of it leaked, and there was a great outcry in Philadelphia, so they pulled off of it. But you know, that was something that was going on as well. It's interesting to think all the things that could have happened.
No doubt. So you could have chosen dozens, hundreds, I don't know, of Michael Jordan games, but the one you picked for the book is April 3rd, 1988, a game between the Bulls and Pistons. Why was this the MJ game to include?
Yeah, the Pistons had some success against the Bulls that season, but what they did not have success doing was stopping Michael Jordan. It was clear that this was just as good a defensive team as the Pistons were. Michael Jordan just had their number, and I believe he had 59 points on this Easter Sunday game. It was on national TV, and he just absolutely killed them. What happened after that game? And it depends. Depends who you ask. Some guys at the time say it was a different game. But you know, Brendan Sir was an assistant. He pointed to this game, and Chuck Daly had at one point as well. He pointed to that game as the one where they sat down and said, "We've got to change the way we do things with this guy." And that's where they invented the Jordan rules. And the Jordan rules were important because not only it's important in a lot of ways, because it changed the way that the Pistons approach things. Obviously, they were already a physical team. They went all in. They went just all in. Anybody comes in the lane, we're going to smack them. We're going to knock them to the floor. We're going to hit them after the shot. You know, we're going to be the bad boys. That's sort of where that comes from. And then of course that sets up the whole 1990s, the way basketball is played in the 1990s, where it really does get ugly, you know, where that is, how the game is played. So there's that track. And then there's also the track where Michael Jordan, you know, physically starts to feel, you know, what the Pistons are doing, and other teams do it to him. And he feels like, you know, that's when he gets Tim Grover. And that's when he says, I've got to be a different cat physically here. I've got to do some different stuff. And that's where he really, you know, dedicates himself to becoming the Michael Jordan who wins six championships. So that game, because Chuck Daly was so frustrated with their inability to stop Michael Jordan, that set up the NBA for the 90s, and it also set up Michael Jordan, what he would become.
How did Michael respond in the moment? Like, what was the what was the post game Jordan commentary like after getting the shit kicked out of him?
Yeah, when that started happening, he would say one of his quotes was, "That's not basketball," he did a lot of complaining. Obviously, they would get Phil Jackson as their coach, and how Phil is with the refs and all that, and the well chosen words that he would have in terms of that. So there was a lot of complaining, but I think in the end, what Michael Jordan, no matter what he said, he knew he had to actually do something physically different. He did a lot of complaining about it, and you can go and look at the quotes. I mean, he pretty much said, that's not basketball what they do.
I mean, he's not wrong.
Right. No. And, the 90s were, there were some great teams, but man, it was a hard game to watch at times. Some of the things that went on.
Yeah. It's wild because, during that period of time, I'm still, I'm a Californian by birth, and, I'm still out there for the entire 90s. The Bulls from a distance, if you weren't a hardcore fan of any other team, everybody was a Bulls fan by default in the 90s. Everybody loved to watch Michael and Scotty, and nobody probably outside of Detroit enjoyed what the Pistons were doing. Nobody outside of New York enjoyed what the Knicks were doing. And of course, I've now been in New York for almost two decades. And the way that the 90s are glorified as this utopian version of the NBA by certain fan bases specifically, certainly New York, certainly Detroit. And I think there are others who are kind of nostalgic for it. I mean, I think some players who grew up watching that still kind of say like, that was the real NBA, that they liked the physical version of it. It was not enjoyable for most fans, I don't think. And I don't think it was good for the game. There's a reason the NBA, tried to evolve a little bit, take out not all the physicality, but some of it and crack down on flagrants, and then eventually change up other rules that allowed the game to kind of flow a little bit more. It's an interesting period of the NBA. It's different. And I think it can be enjoyable in its own right, but I don't think it's as aesthetically pleasing.
And we saw that after Michael Jordan retired. Like now, once he was gone, there were some years that you obviously had the Lakers run. I'm pretty sure you were at the 2003 finals, which was the Nets and the Spurs. And you might remember, one of the games, I think it was game three or game four, it was like 78-69. Like that was the NBA. I remember Greg Popovich saying we just set basketball back 15 years. And he was right. I mean, it was just ugly, ugly stuff. Once Michael Jordan wasn't there anymore, it was kind of like, this is a tough thing to sell.
Yeah. Yeah. They had some things to fix. This is a really bad segue. Speaking of fix, terrible segue. I do not believe that. By the way, I'll just put that on the record first. So May 2002, Western Conference Finals, Lakers and Kings. This was an epic freaking series, by the way, which I think now gets overshadowed in some corners by the Game 6 officiating controversies and everything that went with it. But Lakers-Kings was awesome. There were a lot of moments. This is also the series that includes Vlade Divac tipping out the miss by, it was Kobe misses, Shaq misses the putback, Vlade Divac tips it out, yeah. Robert Horry, just scoops it up, says, oh, look, a three-point opportunity, drains it to hit that one. And of course, the Lakers eventually win that in overtime of game 7 in Sacramento to go to their third straight finals, and that's when they beat the Nets for the three-peat. This is a game that people remember for all the wrong reasons and the controversy, the conspiracy theories. Tim Donaghy keeps dredging it up as a way to try to paint everybody else as crooks because he is. And so he thinks the way to defend himself is by saying, oh, the whole thing is corrupt. And he's preying on the ideas and concerns and suspicions people have long had. We don't need to necessarily go down all that road. But Sean, you decide only on 12 games. What about Lakers Kings? As epic as that series was, and clearly it's a key moment in the Shaq Kobe era. Why that game with all that is wrapped up in it?
Yeah, I think that it really sort of solidified in a lot of people's minds. There was this perception that that David Stern was, altering, that he was directing, that he was, pushing things a certain way. And I actually started off that chapter talking about the Bucks in 2001 against Philadelphia. And they had many of these same complaints. George Karl had talked about it too in that series in 2001. He went back to when he was coaching in Seattle, and they lost a series to Charles Barkley and the Sixers and the Suns to get to the finals. And George Karl pointed out all these numbers about this is something that leading up to that game, there had already been this perception. And I think that game really solidified in a lot of people's heads. I mean, Ralph Nader wrote a letter about it. You had Ralph Nader getting involved.
Famous NBA fan Ralph Nader. I'm not sure Ralph Nader could have named five NBA players at the time he wrote that letter, but suddenly he decided this was a big consumer issue. Major respect for Ralph Nader and what he's done in this country over the course of his lifetime and career, but that was maybe a little opportunism.
A little bit. You had like Michael Wilbon saying, this is the worst referee game, and anybody who suspects the NBA of something, this is the kind of thing that is going to confirm it to them. So I do think that game was important in terms of solidifying that perception, and the league then did take steps afterwards and did try to be, or has tried to be, much. I don't think you hear that as much anymore. And I think it's in part because the league has tried to be more transparent about its officiating, more transparent about how these, about how calls are made and how referees are graded, and things like that. Now, you're still going to get, Scott Foster doing this, and you still get that. But I think it's not the same as it was 20 years ago where there was a significant number. I'm sure you had it too. Like, you'd go on radio shows and that's what people were talking about is is this thing fixed or not? It's hard as a sports writer to make that judgment. Especially if this is the sport you're covering. But it was very much a pervasive thought at the time. And I think that game, sort of symbolized that. You're right. That Tim Donaghy has made a lot of hay out of that game since then. It really was a reflection of the thought process at the time.
Sean, I mean, you've probably heard this too or seen this too. Donaghy has made so much hay out of it and preyed on the suspicions about that game and about NBA officiating and NBA conspiracies in general so often that people will now say, oh, you remember that Tim Donaghy game where he fixed the game, the Lakers and Kings. He wasn't even on that. He didn't work that game.
It was
three of the referees. It was Ted Bernhardt,
Pavetta, and Delaney.
And Bob Delaney, yes. Bob Delaney, former undercover cop, and certainly not the kind of person who was going to be involved in referee conspiracies, I don't think. Right. Nor do I think that Ted Bernhardt or Dick Pavetta were either. But Dick Pavetta was always one of those figures back then. Referees, of course, were much more colorful in that era. Pavetta, chief among them. And I think a lot of that contributed to how people perceived the refs as like a force in their own right. And I think it's part of why the NBA now prefers that referees showed no personality whatsoever on the court. It was a different time, but yes, people now believe, because of the conflation of all these things and Donaghy pounding on this all the time, that somehow he was part of that. And that he's the one who made sure that the Lakers won the game. He wasn't there. But conspiracy theories have all, you could do an entire book just on NBA conspiracy theories, right? Like this league, for whatever reason, spawns more of these than any other. None of them have a lick of evidence behind them, but people believe them based on suspicion, based on perceptions, based on whatever. And back then, you pointed it out, The coaches fueled this. Every time a small market team lost, and there was even a hint of like, well, we didn't get it to the line as many times, then George Karl or somebody is saying it's because the league doesn't want us to win. And that was such a that's why David Stern was constantly fining coaches. That's why we have all these fines in the NBA for speaking out, complaining about officiating. It's not so much that they're trying to protect the refs from being criticized. It's more that coaches, especially sometimes players, but mostly coaches, were politicking so much back in the 90s and early 2000s. And it's corrosive because it then gives fans reason to believe, well, if the coach says the refs screwed them and maybe it's part of some conspiracy to favor the big markets over the small markets, well, then I, the average fan, I'm going to believe it. And so like, that's why the league tamped down, because it's just, it's there's nothing, there's no proof behind it. It's just suspicion. But when it comes from voices of authority like coaches, it starts to kind of take root out there.
Yeah. And certainly Rick Adelman, after that game, you know, he came out in his press conference and, you know, all but said that, yeah, the refs wanted there to be a game seven. You know, he didn't say it in so many words, but Divac said much the same thing. But you're right. Yeah. The more that those things, and, you know, we talked about Phil Jackson, I mentioned him earlier, you know, he was a master of that, right? I mean, he was a master of working the refs in such a way in game five, so that he got a lot of calls in game six. Like, he was just with that.
That was a peak time for that, Sean. That series in particular, Adelman and Phil Jackson, every single game, whichever team had lost, immediately went to the play to the ref's card, and we got screwed by the fouls last night. And like, telling, you know, I know because I was covering the Lakers, they're telling us on the side, go back and look at these three plays. You know, there's like in game five, I think it was when the Kings won and the ball had gone out of bounds off of Chris Webber, but they called it off of Derek Fisher, and that sets up, I think, the Mike Bibby shot or something, if I'm remembering correctly. But there's a lot of those, and I remember the Lakers flagging like, oh, watch, they screwed up these three, or, you know, they were politicking the whole way. Both teams were. It was going back and forth. It's part of why that series was so much fun, because everybody was talking so much shit about each other, about the refs.
Right, and you know, I mean, you know, Shaq, you know, as you know, he was the hardest guy in the world to ref, and Vlade Divac was the second hardest guy, because, you know, anything, you know, he originated the flop. I mean, he mastered that. You know, he's one of the reasons that we wound up having flopping rules was Vlade was so good at it.
Yeah, and nobody talks about the flip side of it in this. So this is like, by the way, I'll just be clear. I don't believe in a conspiracy. I'm not going to defend what the referees did that night. I've never gone back to rewatch the game to see just how egregious some of these were. In real time, it's hard because I'm on deadline. I'm writing the whole time that I'm covering the game, right? So you're, as things are happening, you're scribbling, you're typing, you're whatever. I have no clue. I've never rewatched it. I should one of these days. So I don't know. I'm agnostic on even whether the referees screwed it up. But to your point, Sean, Shaq was incredibly difficult to referee, to officiate, period, because of his physicality and how strong he was. Vlade was absolutely a flopper. And there were definitely some questionable things that happened in the course of that series in both directions. And as I always say, game seven in Sacramento, the Kings had every opportunity.
Yeah, it's funny. I talked with Scott Pollard about that. He said the same thing. He said, look, no matter how you feel about game six, we screwed this up. You know, we shit the bed. We went back to Sacramento, game seven, that building. You remember how loud that building used to get? We had everything and we shit the bed in game seven. That's how Paul put it. You know, he said, I don't worry much about game six. It's game seven that bothers me.
Yeah. So the last chapter of the book is kind of self-explanatory. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but Steph going for 54, hits 11 of 13 threes. And I, you know, in a lot of ways really kicks off the three-point era that we're in, and also kicks off the Steph era that we're in. That one, we don't need to go down deep on that one, but I want to just bring it up because so people know, like, the last game is from 9 years ago, so it's recent history, but it's just long enough ago to remind us that the game didn't always look quite this way, and Steph wasn't always this supernova. Anyway, so the 12 games, they're all fascinating in their own right. They all have an importance in their own right. You also have Dirk at the Nike Hoop Summit in 1998. So that kind of stands in for the international evolution of the game. There's just a bunch of really great stuff. So before we go, we'll talk a little NBA. But again, people, the history of the NBA in 12 games by Sean Devaney is in bookstores, I believe, November 1st on sale.
That's right. Yep.
Probably in all the usual online places that people can go look for it, too. So before I let you go, a couple things just around the NBA. So you're in Springfield, Massachusetts, as I mentioned earlier. You're a New England guy. You came up on the Celtics. Give me your just snapshot impression of where the Celtics stand today, a week out from the Ime Udoka news and his suspension. Where do you think it leaves this team as they kind of pick up the pieces, get over the initial shock of this, you know, just the news and the whatever the scandal aspect of it, for lack of a better term?
Yeah.
I never know how to project on these things. There's a human element here, but they're going to be on their third coach in 3 years because of this. Udoka was such a key figure for them last year in galvanizing this team and them going to the finals. Sean, you know that franchise really well. Give me your quick thoughts on where this leaves them and on the decision that the Celtics made.
You know, I thought under Brad Stevens, you know, you mentioned third coach in 3 years. So under Brad Stevens, one of the problems that they had was that they were a pretty fragile bunch. They really didn't. Brad was reluctant to call people out publicly. You know, so you get Udoka in, and he's the complete opposite. He will absolutely take you to the mat. And I thought by the end of last year, they were a much tougher team than they were, you know, when they were blowing 20-point leads. I think it happened 4 or 5 times early on in the season. And I thought MA really toughened them up. Now we're going to see whether, you know, did he really, is that something that's going to carry over? You know, that's going to be a real test. Is this team mentally tough enough to put all that stuff aside? I think it worked out well for them that, you know, I mean, obviously you don't want any of this stuff to happen, but the fact that it all came out right before media day, they came out, you know, they kind of said, well, I don't know, you know, nobody tells us anything on media day, and they're probably not going to get asked about it much more. You know, it's not going to be, if they can come out and play well early in the season, it's going to fade pretty quickly, you know, even as much of an earthquake as it was when it happened. So, you know, I think that this is going to be a real test of their toughness. But, you know, I think that certainly at this point, I think they've handled it about as well as they could have. You know, I'm curious about some of the things that the guys said when, you know, that about, well, you know, we don't know anything. We know as much as you guys do. I don't buy that.
I don't either.
But I do think that, you know, I do think that addressing it as quickly as they were able to, and now just getting right into training camp and right into preseason, I think that's going to be good for them as far as putting it behind them.
Yeah, I think so, too. I guess to some extent, this will be the latest test of just how important is the coach to a team, right? Like once you're established and you've got an identity and you've got high level talent, finals level talent, which they do. Okay, how much does a coach matter? Because we debate that sometimes in this league, right? How much is about the talent and how much is it about the voice and the schematics and pulling guys together? And Udoka really pulled this team together and got them to break through in a way that they didn't under Brad. Can Joe Mazzulla just kind of pick up the baton and keep going in the same direction? The bigger news for them, or the bigger concern immediately on the court, is going to be Robert Williams. You broke the story that Robert Williams was going to have knee surgery again, and he's out for a bit. He's obviously had repeated concerns with that knee and injuries, period, in his young career. Where do you think that leaves them? Do you Maddox and I have talked about whether they should be going out and picking up Dwight Howard or DeMarcus Cousins or somebody. Where do you think this leaves them?
You know, I think that they will pick up somebody if they feel like the guys that – if they feel like what they're doing. They're doing something interesting. They're doing something that, you know, really happens a lot in football, right, where you have position battles, you know, for those last roster spots. And they've kind of decided that, you know, for their last 2-3 roster spots, they're going to have, you know, all these guys come in and basically, you know, Denzel Valentine, you know, guys like that coming in, Justin Jackson – coming in and trying to earn a spot. As things progress, I mean, right now, Luke Kornet is going to play a pretty significant role. I think if they get to the end of November, and they say Luke Kornet cannot handle this, then you'll see them, seeing what else is out there. They're very conscious about the luxury tax. I mean, that's they're going to go with 14 guys. They're way over the luxury tax. They're sort of in the situation that the Warriors were last year, where if they sign a guy for at a minimum, if it's $2.5 million, they're going to pay, almost $15 million in luxury tax. And so they want to try to avoid that or put it off as long as they can. And if that means that we get a lot of Luke Kornet in November, we'll see if the guy's done it. We'll see. Or Kevin Gealy, who's on a two-way contract, but he could get moved over. I don't think that they're going to be looking to sign one of those guys unless we get to December and it's obvious that they need somebody.
This raises the age-old question: how much Luke Kornet do you have to see before you realize it's worth spending an extra $15 million in luxury taxes? I believe that's one of the age-old NBA quandaries.
I think this is Luke Kornet's eighth team, so there's eight other teams that have answered that question.
I saw him. He had a turn with the Knicks here in New York, yep. So I saw him briefly here. We were both judges for the NBA's hackathon, which is when they're. they're getting all the data nerds in and to do their thing. So I met Luke there. Very nice guy. Not sure I want him as my heavy minutes center on a plausible contender in Boston. But, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. And, give him a chance. Let's see.
Absolutely. Sean, this has been great, man. Appreciate you coming on. The book is fantastic. Again, The History of the NBA in 12 Games. People go find that at bookstores everywhere on November 1st or online in all the usual places. Go find Sean's work, of course, at heavy.com. Sean, this has been great, man. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Howard. Sure, we'll catch up down the road.
Absolutely. Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Sean Devaney. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.